Hi, I'm Phelan Johnson.
And I'm Leah Simone Bowen, and we look at history a bit differently. Have you ever wondered how hundreds of wild horses came to inhabit an island in the Atlantic Ocean?
Or what Lord of the Rings and a small town in Manitoba have in common? Or the burning question, did Canada invent the teen drama?
The Secret Life of Canada is a podcast about the country you know and the stories you don't. New episodes available now wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Susanna Hoffs from the Bengals has a new book. I'm not going to say it's her story because it's a novel, but it is a novel about a young woman who's looking back to a time when she made big hits. So Susanna's here to talk about that novel, but also to look back on her own career, the hits she had with the Bengals, Prince walking out and shredding during their sets, and why making art is like a healthy psychosis. Susanna Hoffs coming up. Plus, Crown Lands, a band from Oshawa, Ontario. I'll be honest with you, I always thought they sounded a lot like Rush, so much so that I was sort of afraid to mention it to them. Then you find out in this interview, it's very intentional. In fact, they'll tell you the story about the time someone from the Rush family looked at them and said, it's your job to carry Rush's torch. Crown Lands are coming up. I'm Tom Power. You're listening to Q. The Bengals and Hazy Shade of Winter, originally by anyone? Simon and Garfunkel. The Bengals, I guess, they're one of those bands that when you think about the 80s, they're one of the big ones that kind of pop up in your head, right? Like, their lead singer, Susanna Hoffs, was this incredible singer and guitar player and songwriter. She wrote some of the biggest songs of the decade, you know, Eternal Flame, Walk Like an Egyptian. But, you know, even though those were big songs, and even though Susanna and the Bengals continued making music, that era was a while ago. And that leads me to Susanna's newest project. It's a novel called This Bird Has Flown, and it's about a musician who had a hit record a decade ago, and now she's trying to navigate her life afterwards. Listen, it's not an autobiography. I mean, for one, the lead character's name is Jane. She's in her early 30s. Her husband has left her for this young actress. But, you know, there's enough parallels that we get to talk about her novel. We get to talk about fulfilling her dream of writing it. And we get to talk about the Bengals and the moment they were approached by Prince to work together, about why it might be impossible for a band to stay together. Susanna Hoffs joined me over Zoom from her home in LA. How are you?
I'm doing so well. The whole adventure with the book was a kind of left turn in my life as a person who makes things. It was a joyous experience. I don't know how else to describe it. It was unexpectedly delicious and lots of work.
Yeah.
But permission to live in my imagination with these imaginary characters who really sprung to life. And I feel like I know them, like they're actual humans, flesh and blood and beating heart and all that, you know, like, but it's been so fun.
People say that. Like, I just had someone on the other day who said that, like, he wrote a play and afterwards the characters in the play stayed with him and were like talking to him.
Yeah, it's a form of psychosis maybe, but the best kind. I mean, it's, you know, my book is an adult book, but it felt like child's play in a way. And of course, being a lover of music, I like to say that music is the beginning, middle, and end of every day for me. Like, I kind of score my life as if it's a sound, like it's a soundtrack playing to just kind of go along with me through the day. But the music that I sort of began to cobble together a little playlist because I listen anyway. And weirdly, the characters would just start talking to me. And it was almost like a movie screen in my brain would come down and I'd just see them. Even if they were a bit amorphous in terms of like the details of their features or what color their hair was, or, you know, I didn't need the details. I just kind of felt them and was like in the room with them. And it was really interesting. It was such a lonely thing writing a book on some level, but actually it wasn't.
Yeah.
In many respects, you do feel like you're hanging out with these people.
Is this something you had always wanted to do? I have to admit, I was a bit surprised. I mean, I figured when the first time we would talk, it would be about some, you know, rock memoir or about a record or something like that. Like,
yeah.
Was writing a novel something you always wanted to do?
Actually, it was It was something kind of burbling under the surface. It was something I'd always dreamed of. And I've always loved reading novels, and I love consuming fiction in all forms. I mean, I'm one of these people who, like, every night my gift to myself is to watch a movie or binge a show. And I, you know, wake up in the morning, I've got my audiobooks, I've got my physical books or on a Kindle. I'm always, like, my favorite place to be is in a fictional world and sort of not ruminating on my own life. It's escapist, I'll admit it. It's escapist, but I think it's a very, for me, it's kind of mental health. It works on a mental health level to just keep me not distracted per se, but just, it's so pleasurable. And as an artist who has worked in various medium, I always longed to write a novel. So I just took the plunge. It was the prodding of one of my kids, my older son, Jackson. And that's when I thought, what am I waiting for? Like, yeah. This has been something I've always wanted to do. So I took the plunge.
Let's do some work here now. Let's talk a little bit about the plot here. So the book, This Bird Has Flown, is in some ways the story of Jane Start, a 33-year-old musician who had a big hit about a decade ago, is trying to navigate a career in the music world, dealing with a broken heart, dealing with sort of reestablishing who she is both professionally, sort of in terms of her vocation, in terms mm-hmm. of who she loves. It's sort of a romantic comedy. Tell me about this character and tell me a little bit about what excited you about her.
Well, when I first was, given the edict from my son Jackson to just stop talking about it, Mom, just talking about this so-called book you're going to write. And when I had to sit down and really grapple with who are the characters, what is the story, I definitely wanted to have the protagonist be a performer of some type. And maybe because I've been one in my life, and I just thought I would understand that, the complexities of that world. But it was interesting. A lot of the time in the writing of the novel, I was swept up in the romance part of it, in the idea of a bad breakup leading to a really wondrous series of months where you're in that first blush of a new love, and it's so sexy and fun and titillating, and you're just, you know, but then I realized that I did have this opportunity to dive deep, go deep into the experience of, for example, what it feels like to walk out on a big stage and see all these eyeballs staring at you
yeah.
and grapple with your heart beating. I always like to say so loudly, you're afraid they can hear it too, because, you know, every time I walk out onto a stage, no matter how big or small it is and how many people are staring back at me and I'm looking out at them, there is a kind of moment where you, in order to actually sing and do your job, you have to turn off all of those buttons or whatever it is where you have to work with the adrenaline you have, but you also have to be able to perform. Your fingers have to move. If you're a guitar player, your voice, which is so vulnerable to, like, going out of whack if you can't, you know, settle into the groove of singing. So I was able to put some of those details that were honestly fairly, you know, I didn't really think about it that way until I had to put it on the page. I didn't realize that that was like a process that I personally go through. So I was able to give certain little things like that to Jane.
I really like sort of the realities of being a musician that you talked about in this book. And again, like you said, there's like these are perspective that you can have for either being as a solo artist or your time in the Bangles. Like, that can be everything from, like, the fight between ambition and, like, I don't want to spoil anything here, but, like, the fight between ambition and something being offered to you, but, like, you have this personal life that you're in love with and you have to sort of make those kind of decisions. Or even, like, the beginning of the book I really loved, because I feel like most people who know the lives of musicians don't know the kind of world of corporate gigs and private gigs. And, like, I've done a lot of those, and they're the weirdest gigs. And they're, like, I remember doing one time, and we played for, like, I want to say we played like a 45-minute set. Nobody listened. I got off the stage, and someone came over to me and said, "Oh yeah, hey, nice to see you. When are you guys on?" And I was like, "Oh my god!" Like, it's just
I know.
It's the most soul-sucking thing, you know?
I know. I'm so glad to know that I'm not the only one who's experienced that. That's so interesting. Yeah, I mean, there is this whole world that burbles below the surface of what normal fans of musicians or people who love music and go to concerts have awareness of. And, you know, it's the world of these private gigs where, I mean, some, and there is a range, you know, there is a range. Like I've heard stories of very famous people playing billionaires' islands and so on and so forth. But the one that the book begins with is, you know, set in Vegas. I can say that. I don't want to give away too many spoilers for people who haven't read it. But it's just a sort of Jane start grappling with where she's at this moment in her life. And she's at a low point, but she's one of those people who there's some fire in her. Even when there are people who are difficult to manage or that she has questionable feelings about, she just ultimately kind of loves everyone. She's a person who really craves connection. And I loved writing about that in the book. It was so much fun. My husband, as I said, was so shocked. Like, writing is hard and arduous. And like, why are you giggling and laughing to yourself? I don't know. They would just start talking to me, the characters. It's a form of madness.
I like the idea of what you called it earlier. It was like, it's like a helpful psychosis. I'm also like struck by what you said earlier, because I am so glad, Suzanne, that you made the protagonist a musician. And I'm happy that you said that the kind of music bookends your life and the sort of the beginning and the middle and the end of your day. I want to play you some music right now to talk about your story a little bit. Not the Bangles, but I want to play you something. Just take a listen.
Okay, please do.
Okay.
Oh my God.
I think I'm going to be sad.
So that is The Beatles and Ticket to Ride. My guest is Susanna Hoffs, who you might know from The Bangles, from her own solo work. Her new book is called This Bird Has Flown. I heard a story that the Beatles, the actual Beatles, were on your street.
Yeah.
Is this true?
Yes. So in 1964, you can go on YouTube and Google it. And I'm 90% sure it was 64, not 65, because I think they came to LA both years and did the Hollywood Bowl. But so there was a charity event happening down the street from the block that I lived on, which was the street was called Avondale Avenue. And that's where I grew up. And all the kids in the neighborhood got wind of the fact that the Fab Four were in LA, and not just in LA, but they were on our specific block.
Wow.
And most of us were like little kids. I mean, I would have been 5.
Wow.
And music was just, I mean, my mom always says, in your crib, she had the radio and I would just like light up even as a baby, apparently, according to her.
Yeah.
But I kind of believe it because I never lost that weird, like tingling feeling when a song comes on. And it's so cool that you play Ticket to Ride, because the sound of that opening riff, I'm pretty sure is played on a 12-string guitar and maybe even a Rickenbacker, but that jingle jangly riff was, I don't know, it definitely informed all the rest of my journey as a musician. When it came time to buy my first electric guitar, I wanted a Rickenbacker. I wanted that sound.
Is that why you started the band? Is that why you started the Bangles, because of that?
Well, I would say that the glue between Vicky, Debbie, and I, Vicky and Debbie Peterson, Debbie plays drums and Vicky guitar in the Bangles, lead guitar, and I play rhythm guitar. We met through me calling an ad that led me to Vicky, even though it was their roommate who had been their guitarist. It's such a long, convoluted story. But anyway, we met through an ad that I had placed in the Recycler, and I was reaching out to someone else who had placed an ad in that same throwaway paper where you could buy a used couch or a used car, or you could find, it was probably had dating thing in there too, but it also had musicians looking for musicians. And when they came to my house, I was living in the garage on that same block where that Beatles party was. And we jammed the first night. We just decided to be a band right then and there. And it was the love of the Beatles, because this was 1981.
Yeah.
So not everybody in 1981 was thinking about the Beatles.
Yeah.
But honestly, the Peterson sisters and I was thinking about the Beatles, because they had that big of an impact.
Were you playing original music at that first jam, or were you playing Beatles covers? Or
no, that first jam was interesting. They recommended, I'm pretty sure, if memory serves, that we play White Rabbit by Jefferson Airplane.
Oh, cool.
I was like, okay, I'm in. I'm already feeling the vibes.
One pill makes you larger, and one pill makes you small. And
Vicky remembers I was wearing a Shangri-La's t-shirt and my mom's suede purple shoes from the 1960s. My mom had really cool clothes in the 1960s, and they remember that impression of me. And my impression of them was that they came with microphones. I was living in the garage in the, you know, where the cars should have been parked, but it was kind of like a little apartment room for me post college. And they set up the mics. I went up to the mic and apparently went like, and they started laughing, like, she's so green. She's blowing on the mic to see if it's on. But I was. But I loved the song White Rabbit. So we just started playing it. And I realized it sounded so complicated when you hear it on the radio or on a record. But it's only two chords.
Yeah.
It's only two chords. But it has that great.
Yeah.
So we did it, and honestly, that night I said, I'm in, let's do a band. And I always describe it as like, we may as well have run off to Vegas and gotten married in an Elvis chapel, three of us. I mean, it was like a leap of faith, and yet somehow I just felt it. I felt like they love the 60s. We just played White Rabbit by the Jefferson Airplane, and it sounded really good. And it just went from there. Who knew?
I mean, I'm hesitant. Like, we're not going to spoil anything in the book. I've already kind of said that to you, but there's sort of, and I wasn't reading the book. I promise, Susanna, I was reading the book as a novel. I wasn't reading it as like a little fact finding. Oh, is that about
you know what I mean? Right.
But it's hard not to a little bit. And like,
of course,
there is sort of a mysterious figure musician in the book. And it made me think of this. Can we play that?
Yeah.
The hero is exposed when his crimes are brought to the light of day. Won't be feeling sorry, sorry, sorry on the judgment day. Wasn't it me who said there'll be a price to pay and I won't feel bad at all when the hero takes a fall?
The Bangles from 84 and Hero Takes a Fall. Susanna, what a song. Great song.
Thank you. You know, it was in that garage that Vicky and I, so I remember sitting on my bed in this garage, and Vicky was like in a chair next to me or something. And I remember that we wrote it with like playing our thighs, you know, the drum beat on our thighs.
Oh, like a...
Yeah. Four on the floor kind of thing. And we were just like pulling ideas from here or there, but we didn't even have our guitars. It was all the rhythm of the, you know, the hero, sorry, 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 on the judge. It was all like written that way, almost like a rap.
Wow.
I mean, I haven't spoken of it that way, but I know you're a musician, so it's just coming back to me, that memory. And yeah, so that was the song that Prince heard.
Yeah,
actually.
So that's what made me think about it. So that's the song that Prince heard, right?
Absolutely. That was the song. He's like, what is this song? Who is this band? And then he would just, he loved that song, Hero Takes a Fall. And he would show up at our gigs and kind of just saunter out, you know, onto the stage shredding. And there's, you can track down on YouTube, like there's one, I think it's audio only, but him just playing a solo that was like on the level of, I don't know, supernatural, in my opinion.
Yeah.
So you mentioned Prince there. Prince goes on to write Manic Monday for the Bangles. That song becomes a really big breakout hit. And then the Bangles' fame kind of just, you guys become world famous. Like, looking back on that now, how do you, what was that time like? Like, what was that fame like?
It was wonderful. It was occasionally fraught. I mean, I think anybody would say this is true. I mean, there was that great documentary. Was it, which band was it? Metallica? Was it Metallica that had the psychiatrist come on?
Oh, yeah. Some kind of monster, the Metallica documentary. Yeah.
I thought that was brilliant. I think because when you do the math, a band of four people, and we have sisters, we had siblings, Vicki and Debbie Peterson. So the complexities of the interpersonal relationships and add in a sibling relationship makes it, you are in a bubble together. You are in the studio too often, but being on the road and living out of a suitcase and kind of like, hello, Cleveland, or whatever those Spinal Tap moments, like you don't really, you start to like, it's an odd life.
Yeah.
It's an odd life. But it was so fun. I mean, it was festive and we were so excited as the public's awareness of our music became, greater and greater. And we had opportunities. We opened for Queen at Slane Castle. All these amazing opportunities to be among our peers in the music business. That was great. But that said, you are on a bunks in a tour bus, if you're lucky to have a tour bus, and you are living like in the closest proximity with your bandmates, and it's bound to be, I don't know how to describe it. It's a little bit difficult to navigate from time to time, but mostly it was great.
First part of my conversation with Susanna Hoff, who you might know as the leader of the Bangles. She just put out her first book. It's a novel called This Bird Has Flown. But come on, let's listen to some music from the great times. This is a song Prince wrote, and this is the song that really kind of made the Bangles' career from 1986. This is Manic Monday. What a jam. From 1986, that is The Bangles and Manic Monday. Coming up on the show, Susanna Hoffs of The Bangles talks about one of their most enduring songs, Eternal Flame. Plus, you'll hear the Canadian band Crownlands. Speaking of the 80s, I always thought they sounded like the band Rush. Turns out, it's very intentional. In fact, a member of Rush's sort of extended family looked at the band one day at Crownlands and said, it's your job to carry Rush's torch. They're going to tell you that story. I'm Tom Power. Q is back.
Think of your favorite one-hit wonder.
Or that overpriced toy your parents would never let you have.
Or that TV show that no one else remembers because it was canceled way too soon. Now what if we could fix it? I'm Francesca Ramsey.
And I'm DeLon Grant. And after 20 years of friendship, we are now hosting a new nostalgia podcast called Let Me Fix It.
Each episode, we'll dig into our favorite celebrities, shows, and brands of yesteryear, and then imagine what it would take to repackage them for relevance today.
Think of our show as an intervention, but with way less stakes.
So subscribe to Let Me Fix It wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
I think the DIY spirit is very strong in me, and, you know, don't give up on something. If you have a dream, you know, go for it.
Tom Power, you're listening to Q. How good does that sound? Hey, you're in the middle of my conversation with Susanna Hoffs, who you might know as the lead singer of the Bangles. She's written a novel called This Bird Has Flown, which is about a woman reflecting on her time in the music industry. So it was a nice opportunity to talk to Susanna a little bit about her own life in the music. If you're not familiar with the Bangles, one of their biggest hits was this song called Eternal Flame. It went to number one in like a trillion countries back in 1989. It's a song Susanna co-wrote. It's a really important song to the Bangles story, so we're going to talk about that. Also, an important song to me personally. I'll tell you that I hope my sister doesn't kill me for the story I'm about to tell. Aaron, I hope you're cool. Here is the rest of my conversation with Susanna Hoffs. Can I tell you something about that song? So that's the Bangles. That's Susanna Hoffs and the Bangles and Eternal Flame. My sister's going to kill me for saying this. She's going to kill me. So when before I was born, my sister and my brother traveled to Prince Edward Island, and they had one of these things where you could go in and make a tape. Like, it was essentially like a karaoke machine. Like, and they would record.
Wow.
And my sister, who was like, I want to say 8, did Eternal Flame.
No way.
Yeah. And every year at Christmas, we have like a big sing-along at my house. And we always get her to sing Eternal Flame to this day. So I just want to say Eternal Flame, unreal song. Like, incredible
Thank
song.
You.
But I know also, I've heard you had like complex emotions when it comes to that song and all that stuff.
Yeah. I mean, it was like the little song that made it onto the album. For whatever reason, by the time we did the, Everything? Was that the last album? We had been on the road together for so long, just sort of jumbled together, not a lot of just sort of autonomy as human beings. And we sort of decided, as we were going to prepare to write the songs that would end up being on the next album, that we all kind of spread out and wrote with other people as opposed to how we had done hitherto, which would have been collaborating with each other a bit more. Everybody was just sort of fried and burnt out from touring and being, all lumped together for so long. So I ended up writing songs with my friend, my dear friend, Billy Steinberg, and his writing partner, Tom Kelly. And so we wrote In Your Room and Eternal Flame together. But I'm walking around with this cassette demo of Eternal Flame and in my pocket practically. And I just was so proud of that song. I wanted everybody to hear it. Do you want to hear my new song? But when it came round to sort of having the band meeting, because in the Bangles, there were 4 singers, and we were very democratic about how we would parse out, who was singing on what songs and all this kind of stuff. But it was one of those weird things where I was convinced Eternal Flame would make the cut, but it didn't. It kind of got voted out of the batch, to my dismay. So we head into making the record. We're about halfway through the making of the record when the wonderful David Segerson, who was such a dream producer to work with, but about halfway through the making of the record, he goes, I have an idea for Eternal Flame. I'm not ready to give up on that song. I know it wasn't picked, but I have this idea. I was really into Patsy Cline at the time. I think the Sweet Dreams movie may have come out around then.
Sweet.
And David had, he knew that I revered Patsy Cline's vocal stylings and that I was singing along to any Patsy Cline music I could get my hands on. And we went over to Phil Chanel's house and we came up with like a little music box kind of arrangement. And then I got to record it. I got to record it. It ended up on the record.
Is this bird?
was so grateful that we got a chance to record it because I was so smitten with that song. So it makes me very happy that you love that song too. I still love playing it. Sometimes now that I'm, when I went on the book tour, everybody said, bring a guitar.
Yeah.
And just, you know, what if you want to break into song? There was always Q&As on the book tour. And sure enough.
So are you singing like Eternal Flame and Walk Like an Egyptian on the book tour and stuff like that?
I'm breaking into song. I have this really cool guitar that I like that I've been schlepping around on the road. And I'm just like, something comes up in the Q&A and I'm like, oh, I think it's time to play a little of this or a little of that. And I'm getting over my stage fright about just doing folk singer style versions of my songs.
Let me ask you this. I mean, the way we sort of approached the book at the beginning, we talked a little bit about where the book came from. And then we were talking a little bit about like, you know, what parts of your story are in this book. I'm sort of curious about the opposite of that before we go. Like, has writing this book made you think differently about your own life in music?
Oh, that's such a good question. You know, I feel like even though I had such wonderful success during the 80s with the Bangles, I do identify with Jane Stark's struggle to some degree. But I can't complain about how my life has turned out since being the kid who's just fresh out of college and advertising herself and making homemade flyers and leaving them at the Go-Go's gig at the Whiskey a Go-Go. I am so grateful that I've had these opportunities and that I had the chutzpah, which is a Yiddish word, I think, that I had whatever it took to just throw myself into following a passion, whatever, and just not giving up. So I didn't really study writing. Again, for me, I studied it just by reading novels over and over again, favorite ones. And the same with music. I'm so embarrassed that I don't read a chart, but I never gave up when I had that passion for something. And I just always want to share that with people because I think the DIY spirit is very strong in me. And, you know, don't give up on something. If you have a dream, you know, go for it.
I hear what you're saying, that not just the writing of the book, this person being a musician was an opportunity to look back on some of the sort of experiences and the way you relate to music over your life, but the actual writing of the book itself was a reminder to you of like, look what I can do. Look what I'm able to do and look what I sort of have always done.
Yeah.
Yeah. Susanna, I got to tell you, what a joy to get a chance to talk to you. Congratulations on the book and thanks so much for making the time.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Close your eyes. Give me your hand. Do you feel my heart beating? Do you understand?
That is a little bit of Eternal Flame by the Bangles, sung by Susanna Hoff. Susanna has just published her first ever novel. It's called This Bird Has Flown. It's out now. And Susanna has also released a new solo album, The Deep End, which is a collection of cover versions. You can find that wherever you get your music. Susanna Hoff's joined me from LA. All right, I'm Tom Power. You're listening to Q. Lady of the Lake from their latest album, Fearless.
So Crownlands, they're from Oshawa, Ontario. They've been compared to the Canadian band Rush pretty much their whole career. You can kind of hear it right now, right? Like the big high vocals and the complex time signatures and the incredible musicianship and the prog. But you got to be careful when you're looking at a musician and saying, you know, you sound like so-and-so. But as you'll hear in a second, there really is no Crownlands without Rush. They've influenced the band in so many ways, not just their sound, but like the way Crownlands live their lives, how they approach their relationships with one another as bandmates is inspired by Rush. Crownlands is made up of Cody Bowles and Kevin Como. They won a Juno for Breakthrough Group of the Year in 2021. Their new album, as I mentioned, is called Fearless. And they came into the studio to talk about it. But I started with this story I had heard about them that they met when one of them mooned the other. Take a listen.
Yeah, Kevin mooned me.
It was a cheeky introduction.
Yeah.
Hello.
He's got the Starman from Rush on his butt. And so immediately when we met, he's like, oh, I heard you were like a big Rush fan. I was like, yeah, like the biggest fan. He's like, oh, yeah, basically. And yeah. He mooned me. I was like, wow, that's impressive. I think we were best friends.
Hold on, what was your reaction when he did that?
Honestly, I was in disbelief. First that he mooned.
Immediately. Yeah. What do you remember about that?
Vividly, yes.
I'm still going to be talking about it on the CBC in 10 years.
You know, I mean, it's a good moment for sure. I mean, I think it's one that defines our friendship. I heard Cody was a big Rush fan, so I figured I got to make a good impression. So just what better way than pull my pants down and mooning them?
When did you get the Rush tattoo?
Oh, geez. I think when I was 18. It was a spur of the moment thing. Like, I went with my mom as emotional support for her. She was getting like a lizard tattooed on her foot. And while I was there, I was like, yeah, let's get my butt tattooed.
What I really love about the story is that you weren't like, I'm going to get a Rush tattoo on my arm where perhaps everyone's going to see it.
Yeah. It's just for me. Yeah. And Cody. And my wife.
Cody, when did you get into Rush?
Oh, man, I was into Rush as far as I could remember. My dad was a massive Rush fan. He's a drummer, too. So he started me on drums when I was like a year old, literally. And he used to play like Rush songs all the time in the basement, and I would listen to him. So I actually knew of Rush before I actually heard an album. I heard my dad playing it on the drums. And it's just like a family staple in my household.
A Monday warrior, mean, mean stride. Today's Tom Sawyer, mean, mean pride.
That's a beautiful thing. How about you? When did you hear
that? It was kind of the opposite, really. My parents... collectively, their least favorite band was Rush. And
what kind of music did your family listen to?
My mom's a big Eagles fan.
Yeah,
And my dad's a real big folky. In fact, he grew up just across the street from Gordon Lightfoot, and so that made a huge impression on him. And he got big into Dylan. And when I was 14, getting into music, I started playing bass when I was 11. And as a bass player, you want to find the most accomplished bass playing to emulate. Uh-huh. And of course, Geddy Lee just kept coming up in conversations. And as a way to rebel against my parents, because they were into the punk rock that I was into at that point, I was like, well, they don't like it when I blast Rush, so I'm going to do that. Exactly. And I remember hearing Xanadu for the first time when I was like 14, right? I downloaded it onto my iPod Nano and I went for a bike ride. And it completely changed my life trajectory.
It's a beautiful thing. The band gets together. I want to play a bit of the song that kind of got you started on your path. Take a listen to this.
First impressions, second chances.
I mean, you can kind of hear it there, right? That is Context, Fearless Part 1 by Crownlands. Someone tell me the story of this song. Maybe could you tell me the story of this song? My understanding of it is that, I know we've been talking about Rush, and I promise we'll stop talking about Rush.
No, it's okay.
But my understanding of it is that this is an important song inside of kind of the story of the band.
Yeah, for sure.
And it involves one of a producer who worked with Rush. Is
that's
that right?
Right. Yeah,
tell me the story.
Yeah, so we started writing the song in 2017, and then we met Terry Brown, who was responsible for the first 10 Rush records, which was surreal, right? And then
where did you meet a guy like that?
Oh man, we just like met up at this restaurant.
Through a good friend of ours, Paul Luxis. He was in beer advertising.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
We had done a number of shows for Drink Inc., which, as it turns out, was ran by Emma Brown, Terry's daughter. And we grabbed lunch with him one day. He invited us to his studio, and we had been writing and arranging context. Cody, take it away.
Yeah. So basically, we got this demo down, and then afterward, we signed with our agents and our manager and our label, and then we were on a bunch of tours for a long time, and then the arrangement changed. Kevin got a double neck. We wanted to play it live, and of course the song just naturally changed over time, so we figured that we had to re-record it. And so we ended up reaching out to Nick Raskulinix, who was responsible for the last two Rush records, and we were going down to re-record it, and the day before we went down, Neil passed. And it was a horrible moment for both of us. And then we were all packed and ready to go. And we got a text from Nick saying, we still got to do this. You know, you guys have to carry the torch. And it was a really deeply touching
carry
moment.
Carry the torch.
Yeah. And he said that to us. And it was really moving. And it was a very emotional time. And we all got together and just listened to Rush all the time and tracked these things, tracked these two songs as like kind of like a tribute. It was a big turning point for our music because we were leaning more into the progressive stuff, and it really set the tone for what was to come afterward.
I mean, it's a beautiful thing. Kevin, are you comfortable with the Rush talk? Like, are you? Are
yeah.
You, are
oh, you, absolutely. Like, I don't think you can really talk about Crownlands without talking about Rush because we owe so much to them as musicians, but also as people, right? Like, Rush influenced us so deeply. Because you see the friendship and the respect they have for each other, like 40, 50 years onward. And the way that they were able to live balanced, nuanced lives. Because, you know, most of the time when you pursue rock music, you lead a lifestyle that is not conducive to being able to build a family and also have, you know, respect for one another. Because, you know, being a musician and being in a band, like, it tears down a lot of boundaries and a lot of barriers.
Yeah,
and a lot of the time,
yeah,
there's a reason why most bands last, you know, 5-6 years, right?
Yeah.
They were able to maintain a career for 40 years. Yeah. And
we respect that and honestly, like, carry that in our friendship.
Yeah.
Oh, I love that idea that it's not just musically that Rush would be an inspiration to you, but also in terms of like how they live their lives.
Well, yeah, for
sure. How they loved one another in that band.
Yeah,
I remember I got to talk to Alex one time, mm-hmm. and I said, we were just backstage, and I said, Alex Lifeson, the guitarist in Rush, and I said, how did you guys, you know, keep it going for so long?
Yeah.
And he said that. He was like, honest to God, we just laugh a lot. We just like tell stories and laugh and tell jokes. And like whenever bands would come in, I'm not going to say which band he was talking about, but like other, I think you guys might know who I'm talking about. We're not going to say who it is, but like other bands would come in and they would be like really taking it, you know, kind of fighting one another and going the sort of corporate route. Not only did Rush outlast all of them,
mm-hmm.
but they found them really funny. Let me ask, can I ask about the name? Where did the name?
Crownlands.
Yeah, I mean, I obviously know about Crownlands.
Yeah, yeah.
Talk to me about how you landed this on this for the name.
So we were basically flipping through and rolling dice and pulling names out of hats for a while, and nothing was really sticking. And then we were doing this photo shoot, and somebody mentioned Crownlands, and then we went and just did like our own kind of homework and due diligence and research, and we were like, well, actually, this is actually really important, and I believe that, you know, it's important to talk about things that are really important to you and things that you want to be the light that you want to see in the world and the change that you want to see in the world. So I think we chose Crownlands as a way to reclaim the term for, like, you know, Indigenous sovereignty, Indigenous land.
You chose Crownlands as a way to reclaim the
exactly
the, yeah.
Reclaim the term. Yeah,
raise awareness that Crownland is stolen land.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think that I'm sure people who might ask you a little bit about the name, might not be as informed that, you know,
of course,
that Crownland still exists. That you know where they come from.
I mean, it's important to recognize, like, all, you know, Crownland in Canada is the old growth forests that have been cut down. It's the oil fields that are used for fracking, and it's used for Indigenous reservations. Where,
mm-hmm.
you know, when the Indian Act was formed, when the CN Railway was put in. the Northwest Mounted Police rounded up indigenous people and put them in essentially prison camps. And it's important to recognize that that is what Crown Land is. And it's our way of raising awareness and reclaiming that for the people whose this is their land that we are on.
Exactly.
I mean, it's not just the name. Let's listen to a song. Take a listen to this. That is a bit of Citadel by Crown Lands. Cody, talk to me a little bit about that song.
Yeah, so that song, we really wanted to draw attention to the land and water protectors, specifically in Wet'suwet'en, who are fighting the good fight and are, you know, usually villainized in the media as being antagonists to, like, you know, corporations running as planned. And I think those people should be celebrated because they're some of the only people on Earth left fighting for the benefit of humanity and for the earth.
Kevin, how does it feel when you play those songs live, either in the audience or in the band?
It feels incredibly powerful to play something like Citadel or End of the Road. And I think every time we perform a song like that, you can feel the entire air in the room change, especially for something like End of the Road, where you know, it's a tribute to the missing and murdered indigenous women, children, two spirits along the Highway of Tears. Mm-hmm. And just to get people thinking about these things and then playing very loud, you know, powerful music for it. I think it just brings people together and raises everyone into this system. And it's just, it's magical where you can use music to raise these issues.
I mean, I love the idea. I don't know if I'm going to say this the right way, but like, I love the idea that this is being done, no disrespect to anyone who would do it this way, through soft folk, you know, introspective songs, but mm-hmm. like the idea that you can raise awareness through awesome, loud rock and roll music.
Yeah.
It can be quite cathartic, you know.
I think cathartic, for me, for sure.
Yeah.
Citadel for sure, like, feels like it's a folk song that celebrates the land defenders as the heroes that they are, right? And we've arranged it kind of as like this Bob Dylan-esque strummer, but then it's so much more fun when you bust out, you know, the big old piano ballad and you go into the halftime chorus, and just it hits a certain way, right?
It does.
It's about using music, and music is a tool of expression and sharing ideas.
It's a wild band. I mean, I'm a big fan. I wasn't expecting your band when you came along. We're gonna go out on Reflections from the new album. Cody, can you set it up for us?
Yeah, so this song really is really talking to Kevin and I's relationship, and where we were going through a hard time through the pandemic where we weren't quite getting along. And then we saw the light and realized, you know, we came together and realized we were better, like, you know, together, and forged a stronger bond and relationship through that. So it's really talking about that.
I mean, that's an interesting song to have to play in front of one another.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's one of my faves.
That makes me so happy.
Yeah,
it's a beautiful thing. Well, listen, I'm such a fan of the two of you, can't already tell. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
And congrats on the record. Let's go to the song. That is Crown Lands and Reflections from their album Fearless. Before that, Cody Bowles and Kevin Como of Crown Lands
joined me in studio. If you want to share that interview with the Crownlands or Rush fan in your life, subscribe to our podcast, Q with Tom Power. All right, that is it for the show today. Tomorrow on the show, back in 2006, the Polaris Music Prize went to Final Fantasy, also known as Owen Pallett. Owen turned that win to a pretty incredible career of his own music, also making music for folks like Taylor Swift and Duran Duran and Ed Sheeran. So Owen will be here to talk about remastering some of his old music and why, even though he's had all this success, he wouldn't recommend music as a career. If you want to get in touch with the show, the best way to do that is q@cbc.ca or drop me a line on Instagram. I'm at Tom Joe Power. The show is at CBCQ. We'll see you tomorrow. Later on.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.